720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Lots to do on the program today. We're going to have a slightly shorter show. We're going to end things up at 12:45 instead of 1 o'clock so that we can get you over to the pregame for the Northwestern Wildcats. That's going to be Northwestern versus Penn State today. So that pregame starts right at 12:45. So we're going to cram a whole show into 45 minutes instead of an hour. So lots to do on the program today. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about the changing business at Sundance, how it used to be you'd bring a film and you know, off it'd go, but it's very different, very nuanced now. We're going to be talking about that, as well as the new rule that will soon force companies to disclose CEO pay numbers, which will be really, really interesting. So we're going to take a look at that a little bit later in the show. But right now we have regular contributor to this program, Ryan Ory, on the phone with us. He's a Chicago Tribune columnist covering commercial real estate. Hey, Ryan, thanks so much for being with us today.
Great to be here.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show. I appreciate you taking time out of your Saturday. So recently you wrote a bit more about Amazon HQ2, which we've talked about plenty on this show. And now there is a short list. Chicago is on it for the 20 possible sites of Amazon's second headquarters that they're calling, second, but certainly equal. And it prompted some comments from Governor Rauner and Mayor Emanuel. So give us the latest on kind of where all this stands with this short list. Let's start there.
Yeah, so last year Amazon announced plans to create a second headquarters outside of Seattle that would be where it would create up to 50,000 new jobs, and it caused quite a feeding frenzy among cities throughout North America. There were 238 cities and regions that submitted proposals. And then earlier in this week, Amazon narrowed it down to 20 areas that are in contention. It's a pretty long short list, as these things typically go, but it did eliminate more than 90% of the field. And I think a lot of the reaction in Chicago was, you know, if there's 20 contenders, you know, we should have been on the list. And so it's sort of like, from Chicago's perspective, glad to be on the list, but there's a lot of ways to go to actually win it. So
right, there's a long way to go indeed. And one of the comments made, Rauner referenced taxes and a perception, anyway, excuse me, of kind of a corrupt system here is a possible deterrent. But before that even happened, there was immediately, there's so many conversations happening locally about where that site would even be. I know the post office is one that's been kicked around, but also the site of where McDonald's is now as it moves into Fulton Market area. So there, it's interesting because there's so many layers here about neighborhood and about displacement and then of course politics and narrative, and it's an interesting story because of just how nuanced and multifaceted it is.
There are 10 sites proposed in the Chicago area's bid, two or eight in the city, two in the suburbs, and one of those, as you mentioned, is the McDonald's campus, soon to be vacated campus in Oak Brook. I think it seems more likely that if Amazon were to come here, that it would be one of the more urban locations, but nobody really knows what their thinking is. And that's one fascinating aspect of it. And then the other aspect of it, as you mentioned, was the politics of it, because if you read the, you know, requests for proposals going way back to the start of this, and you read all the different things Amazon was interested in, public transportation, top airport that can get you anywhere in the world, good universities, well-educated workforce. You know, a lot of those things really are great fits, and it really does describe Chicago in a lot of ways. But the other aspect of it is, you know, they mentioned, you know, there was some reference to, you know, sort of taxes and positive place to do business and political stability. And, you know, literally hours after Chicago was announced to still be in the running, the sniping kind of started already. And, I think everyone involved in the bid thought it was unfortunate that on the day there was, you know, good news, the governor started talking about, you know, sort of harping on the one area of shortcoming, whereas everyone else is like, why aren't you pointing to all the positives. You know, why point an arrow at the one thing that could throw this thing off the rails?
Right, right. Why even bring that into the narrative if it's like, if they're not asking, don't bring it up, right? And so what are kind of the next steps? Do we expect another even shorter short list, or do we think the next beat from Amazon will likely be the announcement of where they plan to put the second headquarters?
It's not totally clear. The really interesting thing about this entire process has been, you know, Amazon prides itself on doing things in a very unusual way, unorthodox way. You know, kind of trailblazing, which its business model has, you know, kind of overturned a lot of traditional businesses and been a great disruptor. And their search for headquarters has been extremely public, where they basically invited the entire continent to bid. And it's been very public in releasing the shortlist, but it's also been mysterious in a lot of other ways. They haven't really said what happens next. They haven't really said, you know, what they've examined so far in choosing the 20 cities, what they're still going to do now, what's going to happen, what the timing is. I think people are presuming, people who are involved seem, you know, from the 20 locations, I think are under the assumption that there's going to be a much shorter list down to finalists, and then after that something would happen. But it's not totally clear, and they've never really answered questions about the, you know, specifics of the process.
Right, right. Even the way they announced the shortlist was, in fact, over Twitter, as opposed to a more traditional, you know, announcement with a spokesperson at a podium, something like that. So Amazon indeed mm-hmm. continues to do things their own way.
Yeah, and I think what was really interesting about that was an early morning tweet and press release, and a lot of the you know, a lot of the developers, you know, who have sites in the running here and elsewhere, you know, literally found out about it from, you know, a tweet that they saw come across, you know, their phone or, you know, their computer. And they were, you know, so it is, like I said, very unusual the way it's happened. But from, you know, I guess to Amazon's credit, they've got people very excited. They've got people talking about it. They've generated a huge amount of buzz. And so it's working for them.
Right, indeed. Well, we will continue to turn to you for the latest as this story continues to unfold. Ryan Ori, Chicago Tribune columnist, covering commercial real estate. Thanks so much for being with us, Ryan.
Sure thing.
All right, we're going to take a little break, and in a little bit, when we come back, we are going to be talking about Sundance. As the Sundance Film Festival kicks off, things are being done very differently now as opposed to the system that was in place for a very long time. So we're going to take a look at that and kind of look at some contenders this year. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always appreciate you sharing part of your Saturday with me. A little bit later on the other side of news, we're going to be talking about the new rule that will soon force companies to disclose the ratio between CEO paychecks and the worker paychecks. So we're going to be taking a look at that after news. But right now we're joined by phone by Steven Zajcik. He is the entertainment business reporter at Washington Post. Hi, Steven. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, hey, Amy. How are you?
Great. Thanks. So you have recently written about Sundance, and we have talked about Sundance before in the program. Last year in particular, we were talking after the festival about how things looked a lot different. Long gone are the days of kind of being a big studio swooping in and discovering something. It's so much more nuanced as of last year. And this year seems to be even more so, with really specific things on the want list, it seems like, for people out to make acquisitions.
That's right. I mean, it's the idea, the days of a Paramount or a big studio coming in and you know, swooping in with a big offer to take a movie off the table are gone. But what we've had in their stead are all these streamers, that is Netflix and Amazon, and these, you know, these very deep-pocketed Silicon Valley companies that have moved in to entertainment. And last year, they made some of the biggest buys of the festival. Listeners might know The Big Sick, the movie that Judd Apatow produced that was a big hit over the summer. That was a Sundance buy from Amazon. There's a historical drama now out called Mudbound. Netflix bought for about $12 million, also very big buy last year. So while the studios aren't active, it's been a pretty flush time for the independent film business because of these Silicon Valley companies.
Right. And it feels a bit like a bubble. Like, we talk a lot about bubbles, particularly around Silicon Valley, but it feels a bit that way. Is there danger of this coming to a very abrupt halt with whatever's coming up next on the horizon?
Well, it's a great point, and it's something in my reporting for this story I really did encounter quite a bit, very quietly, because nobody in Hollywood, particularly those making the films or making money from selling the films, wants to say, hey, maybe you guys shouldn't be spending as much money. They obviously want to, strike while the iron is hot, such as it is. But quietly, many do worry about that. And I think if you're a little bit more objective and sort of look at these issues with a slightly more kind of macro lens, and you look at these cycles of boom and bust, of course, not just in entertainment, but in tech and in other business realms as well, you do see these bubbles happening. And so it's entirely possible, as one of the producers I cited in my story said, these streamers are going to basically say, hey, you know what? We have enough subscribers right now. We don't need to spend $10, $15 million to buy a film out of Sundance whose prospects are shaky at best. And they're just going to pull out. And at that point, the bubble collapses.
Right. I thought it was very interesting, too, that you note in the story the very specific genres that seem to be really high on the list, on the want list right now. And to me, that seems perfectly reasonable. But yet also, it seems like once you have a hit, like, say, The Big Sick, let's go find more of these comedies with kind of a gutting moment that also have a health thing attached to them. It seems like that becomes this kind of strange type. And it's like, once you do it once, do you really want to go seek that same type of film again and again?
That's what's been funny. I've been covering this festival for a long time. And I remember when Little Miss Sunshine was a hit here about a decade ago, a little bit more, everyone kind of said, or you just even felt unconsciously, a lot of filmmakers that making movies and distributors looking for movies that were in that vein. And what I and a lot of others said, kind of, hey, wait a second here. Let's take a slightly more sort of sober look at this and realize the next Little Miss Sunshine will probably look nothing like Little Miss Sunshine. So sure. I mean, you can, there are always going to be voices that sound like other voices. And certainly, it's not like filmmakers can't be or won't be influenced by what came before. But the idea that you can just sort of replicate a hit, you can kind of just carbon copy something that worked before and justify the spend and find an audience, obviously, is pretty naive.
Sure. That doesn't sound like a winning plan. It is interesting, though, how you note in the story that the what has occurred since Jordan Peele's Get Out really became this hit, kind of out of nowhere. It was a fairly low budget, $5 million for a movie. That's pretty low budget. And grossing $255 million, significant profit there, significant success on that one, has fueled this desire for specifically a genre dealing with race and identity, which is really interesting. And I think an interesting time in the world for it, particularly as we look at Me Too as that has gone through Hollywood and all there, and all that. I wonder how that's going to shift out. And it seems like it's beginning to.
Absolutely. I think Get Out is really, without exaggeration, one of the single most influential films of our time, not just because it's I think, and a lot of people think, a great work and entertaining and serious. I mean, it has all the earmarks of an important film, but it also, I think, from a business standpoint, has really turned a lot of people on to this idea that you can make a genre movie, at a fairly low budget, which financiers and studios always like, and have it be, entertaining and make money, which we've seen before, but also have it be a serious film that is taken seriously by critics, that has a kind of awards cachet. I mean, the idea of doing that, kind of combining what have long been sort of two disparate strains of filmmaking, which is to say, low-budget genre filmmaking and serious, dramatic fare, is really quite new. And I think, Jordan Peele showed the way with Get Out. And I think, as you say, with Me Too, with, Black Lives Matter, with all these very important issues and causes going on, I think we're going to see more films that capture that. And we've already seen that even at Sundance. Obviously, it's a little too early for Me Too, but we've seen films with race themes. One of the opening night movies was called Blind Spotting with David Diggs of Hamilton fame, and it did a little bit of that as well. It's a sort of kind of gritty street drama that has some genre elements in it, and I think I think we're just going to see more of them.
Indeed. Well, thanks so much for being with us. If you follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet this story out, because there's a lot of really interesting details from a business perspective, specifically around the entertainment industry, or if you just like movies, there's a lot of interesting stuff there. So thank you so much, Steven Zajcik, for being with us today, entertainment business reporter at Washington Post.
Thank you so much, Amy.
All right. So we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Again, we have a little bit shorter show today. We're going to be out at 12:45 and turn things over to Dave Ennett and Joey Meyer for the Wildcats Penn State pregame. That's all coming up here in just under 10 minutes, but plenty to do between now and then. There is a rule that will soon force companies to disclose the ratio between CEO pay and the paycheck of the median worker. And joining us right now to discuss that is Anders Mellen, reporter covering executive compensation at Bloomberg. Anders, thanks so much for being with us today.
Glad to be with you guys.
So talk us through this a little bit and what we're maybe start with what we're likely to learn when this rule goes into effect and the timeline that we're on.
Yeah, so this rule was passed back in 2010 as part of the Dodd-Frank Act following the financial crisis. And starting this year, companies are going to start disclosing the ratio between the CEO's pay and the median worker's pay. Earlier surveys that have been done along these lines show that there's roughly a 347-1 ratio between the median worker and CEOs of the biggest publicly traded companies in the U.S. That is based on aggregate numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and we should be able to, with the new data coming out, get a way more detailed look at each company and at different sectors, because the data will be coming from the company themselves and not from a big aggregated government agency.
And what which companies need to comply with this? Does this apply roundly or just to a specific swath of companies?
It is all companies that are publicly traded, whose stocks trade on a stock exchange. There are a few investment companies and smaller public companies don't have to obliged by this rule, but there's a good amount of them, several thousand, that are going to be mandated to come out with this ratio starting right around the next couple of months, and then it's going to continue for after that.
Right. And what it seems like this is really going to fuel a lot of debate. It seems like it's going to be very contentious once these numbers come out. Are there already any preemptive conversations sort of starting here in this area with the expectation that it will point to a great deal of inequality of pay?
Well, yeah, there's definitely been a lot of concern about this in boardrooms around the United States. People that I speak to that work with company boards and executive teams have told me that executives are concerned because, of course, their compensation is already publicly available. Companies have disclosed that. But now when the workers' pay had to be out there too, the risk is that you may stir up anger among the workers that fall in the second, in the bottom of the median, that earn less than the median worker. And you may also run into trouble with how newspapers and other media outlets are going to report on these matters, because there are certain nuances to this ratio that will be tough for the company to explain in regulatory filings and really be able to get their story out there. And it's of course going to be I think it's going to be a big part of the debate of income inequality going forward. As we know, that's been a contentious issue for years, and there are many Americans that haven't really seen their paychecks increase much in the past years and even decades for some. So another disclosure like this is likely to throw even more fuel on that fire.
Yes, certainly. Well, if people want to head to Bloomberg.com, there's a great piece that you did here that really breaks this down in a very sensical and easy to deal with kind of way that I will be sure and tweet out for anyone who follows me on Twitter. But generally, so this started January 1st. What's next on the timeline? Are we waiting for these disclosures on a certain date?
Yeah, so most companies have their fiscal year ends in December, on December 31st, and then in subsequent months they report earnings, and once that's done, they put out so-called proxy statements, which include information that that companies need to share with their investors before they hold their annual meetings. Typically, those documents come out sometime between start of February and then throughout the year, but most of them come between February and end of May. So over the next few months, there are going to be thousands of U.S. companies that are going to disclose this ratio for the first time, and news outlets like Bloomberg will obviously be watching this very closely and see how it resonates with workers, with unions, and with other interest groups, and also with potentially politicians in Congress.
Yeah, certainly. Well, we will continue to turn to you for the latest. Anders Mellen, reporter covering executive compensation at Bloomberg. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
All right. So we have a couple of minutes left in the program before we turn you over to the pregame for the Wildcats Penn State with Dave Ennett and Joey Meyer. That's coming up in just minutes from now. But, you know, one thing I wanted to mention before we run away is there, because I've gotten a lot of questions about this. People have been tweeting at me. People have sent me some emails about the Google Arts and Culture app where you find your art match. I want to answer that because here's the thing. In Illinois, we can't get it. It's part of a biometrics data privacy law. There's an overabundance of caution from Google entering that space. And so they're like, we're not going to do this. We're not going to play in the facial recognition area. If you are a regular listener of this program, you are familiar with the work of Ali Marati from Chicago Tribune. She has written about this. It is at chicagotribune.com. You can find that. If you follow me on Twitter, you can find this story because I was tweeting about it after I discovered exactly why, because I felt kind of like a dummy because I was searching in this app and I could not find this anywhere, and I was seeing all my friends in other states posting, right? So I think the way around it for now, Griffin, I think what people have to do is you have to have a friend from out of state. You got to send him a picture. You got to take a selfie,
right.
Send it to your friend and go for it.
And what John was talking about during the week on his show, Violetta Podramatic, was actually going manually just through artwork online and matching faces. And you can find it on his Facebook page.
That's funny, but also very time consuming.
I know, but maybe she must have had a system because she did a pretty good job.
Did she?
Elif, Steve Bertrand, John, and herself, and then probably some more too. I actually don't remember. But
okay. John. I don't think I look like anybody. I think I look like kind of weird. So.
That's my favorite thing is like just the wealth of paintings.
Right. Everybody has an art twin. I would love to find my art twin. That would make me very delighted.
So you're sad that Illinois, because this piece that Ali Marati wrote for Chicago Tribune about this rule that's sort of kept it out of Illinois. It's interesting and had a good quote that said they're being overly cautious.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Anyway, we don't have much time. We got to get to...
we got to go. It's about that time, isn't
it? Yes.
Okay, so let us turn you over to Dave Innett and Joey Meyer for the Wildcats Penn State pregame.